You are listening to Null Physics, Our Undiscovered Universe, featuring interviews and discussions focusing on null physics and its modern applications, with scientist and engineer Terence Witt.
Hello, and welcome to the fifth installment in our series of Our Undiscovered Universe podcast. My name is William Reynolds, and I am the moderator. Today's topic is Chapter 1 of Our Undiscovered Universe, Introducing Null Physics, titled Something from Nothing. Before we begin, let me introduce Terence Witt. Mr. Witt is a graduate of Oregon State University, holding a Bachelor's of Science degree in Electrical Engineering. In 1990, he founded Witt Biomedical Corporation and proceeded to acquire numerous accolades within the medical industry for his uniquely intuitive software design. He sold his company in 2006 to Philips Electronics Medical Division and currently resides in Florida with his wife, Ginny. When not working in his laboratory, Mr. Witt enjoys spending time playing tennis, boating, scuba diving, piloting planes, and riding motocross bikes. Hello.
Hello.
Your book claims to answer the fundamental mystery of existence. To a person such as myself who has a background in philosophy, that seems like an incredibly bold statement.
Well, because it is. It's definitely a bold statement. And you've got two choices with that. If you, for instance, can answer this question, if you can come and provide a logical, rational explanation for the universe, you can either kind of hint and say, well, maybe I found it and I think I found it or whatever, or you can just come out and say it. And largely this is any sort of bold statements in science, whether it's, I'll use some bad examples first, whether it's, say, cold fusion or whether it's a Martian meteorite that's got bacteria on it or alien bacteria. These are always, you know, like shunned or cause grave concern in science because lots of times they bold statement or incredible statements require incredible evidence. But then there are other statements that have been made historically, whether it's Copernicus claiming that he could show very clearly and very logically that we live in a heliocentric universe or other similar sorts of things where, you know, those statements come out, they're bold. But this is what happens with a revolutionary movement in science. And what happens historically is, regardless of whether this is right or wrong, there's always a huge reluctance and to even consider the possibility of the worldview being quite a bit different than it is today. And so from a historical standpoint, you look at other bold statements in the past, and they always kind of happen like this is happening with null physics. There's contention, there's, oh, you know, this couldn't possibly be right. There's a refusal to even look at the evidence. But theoretical physics, whether people like it or not, is not really a team sport. I think that vast resources have been devoted to try to convert it into a team sport. But generally, what happens there is when you've got this huge momentum and a lot of people thinking the same way about things, you just don't get you don't get the progress that you're looking for. You can't change the worldview when everyone basically agrees and says it's the way it is. And so both from a historical perspective and just from a practical perspective, you're going to need an interloper coming in and looking from the outside and getting access to perspectives that you don't really see from within the system. So,
from, once again, a layperson's perspective, it appears, at least from the outside, that scientists have it all figured out. You know, what's presented through the media, what's presented through news reports and such as that, it seems that, you know, scientists have a finger on the pulse of what makes the universe go, what the universe is comprised of, and all that. But in reading your book, it's become abundantly clear that that's nothing could be further from the truth, that actually there's a tremendous amount of things that are unknown.
Well, I like to think of the science as it has evolved. When science was originating, we had what we call natural philosophers, where they would kind of sit around, scratch their head, and try to figure out, just using pure reason and logic, why the universe was the way it is, why the universe is here. And then this kind of ran into some dead ends, because unless you just start doing some measurements and trying to quantify your universe, you're not going to get enough information to be able to answer these kinds of questions. You can't just think about it and suddenly, aha, this is why the universe is the way it is. But unfortunately, what happens historically is we seem to go all one direction and then all the other direction. So instead of having the natural philosophy that we had with Lucretius and other Democritus, figured out there were atoms 1,500 years before we were able to really quantify this. So there's this huge power and eloquence and capability with logic, but you need more than that. You need to actually measure the universe if you're going to talk intelligently about it. But unfortunately, what's happened in science is we've switched from thinking and reasoning and logical consistency to a purely empirical, heuristic sort of approach, where we measure everything, we come up with these mathematical models, and we make sure that everything fits into those mathematical models. And so what science has done, they are very confident that their process of measuring and fitting mathematical models is working. Well, it does work, but it is very limited in scope, so that if you've got some equipment and you've made all the measurements that equipment can make, and you put those measurements in your model, you've succeeded to do what you're doing or what your goal is. In reality, though, you've reduced science or physical science to a point of, you know, pure empiricism. And so you can explain certain things. You can say, well, the sky is blue because of the scattering that I can measure and quantify with these other observations or experiments. But what you end up not being able to do is explain the deeper whys of why the universe is the way it is, why atoms have why they're universal constants, why there are these interactions between particles. And so I think there's this false sense of, from scientific perspective or physical science and from the public, that, okay, we're done, we've got it all squared around, there's a few details we need to work out, you know, we might need a bigger accelerator to do these certain measurements. But in reality, there's this huge, just immeasurable amount of places where you can't really do direct measurements, but yet there are so many questions that, just a few of them that I've asked, like, why are particles this way, that science has become complete by virtue, or physical science has become complete by virtue of saying those sorts of questions are not science. And so I'd say the confidence that comes across sometimes is as a false confidence, because there's a lack of perspective here. There's a lack of historical perspective, in that every time the worldview has changed, and just right before it changed, everyone's sitting around saying, oh, well, we've got it all worked out. There's a few details. We know the Earth is flat. We just don't know exactly what the diameter is. And then, kaboom, all of a sudden there's a revolution, and the worldview shifts, and then there's a lot of things to work out. Just like there was a lot of things to work out when quantum effects first showed up. There's a lot of other things. And what it seems to be hard to get across is that you can't take license with the logical consistency if there are any of these little specks of things that don't make sense. A good example is, I recently had a sauna review somewhere, that someone was saying, well, you know, this null physics is wrong because everyone knows that photons don't have any size, and so a photon can't do whatever he was referring to. The funny thing there is, well, a photon has a finite amount of energy. If you're saying it has no size, then you're saying it has no volume. So then you're also saying that it would have infinite energy density, because it's got this finite amount of energy and a infinitely small amount of space. And then, you know, you start that discussion, they say, oh, well, no, the photon's not at any given point in space. It has no size, but yet it's everywhere but nowhere. It's a probability, et cetera. And so you get into these logical inconsistencies that are kind of painted over, put in the corner. But it's these logical inconsistencies that you really have to address to move forward. And that's why I always say, you know, the bigger accelerator, the bigger telescope will add a few data points. But if you really want to shift to a worldview and a paradigm where you can answer more fundamental questions, then you have to recognize all these things that you don't know. Many scientists would like to know the answer to these questions. In fact, I've talked to a couple, and even though they will say, well, this is a philosophical problem, you know, why there are electrons, that's philosophy, that's not science, we need to measure electrons. And to which I counter, well, if you could know why the universe exists, would you want to? Every single scientist I've talked to said yes.
So take, for example, that question, why our universe exists. Is this a question for physics?
Oh, absolutely. It is the number one physics problem. And there are several reasons to say this. One, historically, it was the number one of the biggest problems that the natural philosophers confronted. And generally, since physical science has been rebranded into this empirical realm, we've lost this connectivity to the questions that had merit 1,000 years ago and really never got answered. And the biggest of all of these questions is, why does the universe exist? And the reason why it's a physics problem is because the universe has physical properties. It has these universal constants. It has apparently a very, very large size from what we can see. It's got three dimensions of space. All of these properties. And so there is a reason why these properties are the way they are. Now, the anthropic principle is one of my favorite things to kind of drag through the coals, if you will. It's this idea, well, we've got an infinite number of universes, and they've got all that, these different combinations of parameters, and it just so happens that we live in a universe that where the parameters match well enough that it can provide for our existence and our evolution. Well, that's great. It doesn't answer any question at all. It is the most, it's like saying the Earth, if the Earth wasn't the way it was, then seagulls couldn't fly. Well, the Earth, the actual ontogeny of the Earth shouldn't really be dependent on a seagull, just like the ontogeny of the universe shouldn't be dependent on what a human is. If the universe were significantly different than it is, then we would be significantly different than we are, or we wouldn't exist. So, and then in a bigger sense, with this anthropic principle, we're saying, well, we've got all these universes floating around, and we just happen to be in the good universe. Well, the problem with that is you still haven't answered the question of what these universal properties are. You can say, well, they have the values that they do in order for us to be human, but what are they? What is a universal parameter? Why? And so it's really a huge, the number one physics problem. It started when we were painting on cave walls. It's a problem that Lucretius wondered about, Einstein wondered about, Newton wondered about. It is the number one physics problem. And if you don't know the answer to this question, then you're really not qualified to say how important the answer to that question is. And that's generally what's happened. It's like, oh, well, so we've got this schism between natural philosophy, where they wondered about questions like this, and measuring everything. And by creating a fusion between what you wonder about and the logical consistency with what you measure, you can actually have a physical science that has no boundaries, that has no limits whatsoever.
You know, looking back, you know, specifically when you were talking about the natural philosophers, at that time, philosophy subsumed the other disciplines that we now know as modern science. Why did modern science, particularly the physicists, separate themselves from philosophy? Why did they shift away, you know, in a sense, throwing out the baby with the bathwater, throw out the logic and the reason, and go purely off of data, purely off of experimenting?
Well, I think there's different theories for why that happened, but I would think that the primary reason would be technology. If you're sitting around scratching your head wondering about why we exist, you're not going to be able to build a car engine or a jet engine or figure out how to generate power from coal, for instance. So you've got these pressing, very urgent needs as our technology develops to have some process by which you can measure and predict and use things so you can do some of these designing. And so largely, I think it's for practical purposes that science kind of moved away from that, and also just based on progress. There was no measurable progress scratching your head about these things for hundreds of years. It just became kind of a dead thing where, well, let's see, do I really want to go work in this discipline that has not seen any measurable progress in 200 years? Now, I chose to do that. But I think generally people would not do that.
Well, there, I guess there's no arguing, obviously, that there is a utility in what science has chosen to do. But stepping back then to the question why the universe exists, in your book, you answer why the universe exists. And can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, it's first, to begin with, since it is a huge question, and you're going to, you know, expect to get a similarly huge answer. And the other thing, you can kind of, you know, look at it from a very general case and say, well, if there is a logical, rational reason for why the universe exists, then it's clearly not going to be obvious. People have been pounding their head against this for thousands of years. But again, back in the day when there was a real focus on answering this question, we didn't have a lot of technology. So Lucretius did not have access to the Hubble telescope or the WMAP or any of the subatomic experiments that have been done in the last couple of years. So a couple of decades, I should say. And so when I'm looking for a fusion or looking for a paradigm that will not only conform to the measurements that are made today, but also answer some of the questions that Lucretius was looking for. And so I started by figuring out the best way to phrase this question. And probably the best way is what it really means is, why does the universe exist instead of nothing? We've got billions of galaxies out there. You point your telescope in any direction, you're going to see galaxies. And each one of those galaxies have billions of stars. So we have this enormous amount of stuff out there instead of a void. Now, certainly if there was a void, we wouldn't be around to be looking at it. But there's still this inexplicable disparity. We certainly see places that have relatively empty space, but most of the space of the universe is just filled with all sorts of neat stuff, stars, galaxies. And so it just creates this huge paradox in your mind. It's like, well, okay. But the trouble, you don't just start measuring the stuff and call it a day. You go on to the next step, and you start kind of teasing. You dance around this kind of like dancing around the 800-pound gorilla. You don't go right ahead. You kind of pick away at this equation, this question, and so you ask a better question. So the question really is, why is there something instead of nothing? And the reason why you know this is, the first thing you have to ascertain is that this is a very, very big question, and it's probably what you could say, like I call the existence of the universe the number one physics problem. Well, this question would be the deepest question, because it's actually a question where you're comparing the presence of the universe with its absence, and that's the largest possible difference that you could have. So it really comes down to the biggest question. And so one of the things you notice is, well, we don't really know, for instance, what something and nothing are. We see things like space, and we see matter and energy, and it's got all these cool properties. And so we're trying to say, well, we'll call matter and energy something. But in null physics, what I did is I actually said, you know, when we measure our universe, when we went into this heuristic, empirical sort of regime, we came up with this standard units of measurements, and we're running around measuring the universe as fast as we can. And so what I define in my book as something is things that could be measured if they were large enough or small enough. to be measured. So, for instance, if you can measure a volume, then it's a something. It's something that exists. If you can measure energy, if you can measure time, all these things. Now, that means that's the whole set of things. That's what we would call something. And then for nothing, we just have the converse of that, the things that simply don't have quantity. And so the bottom line was quantity. If it's got this amount, then it falls in the category of something. And so still, the other thing that you'll notice about this question is it is a valid question regardless of whether you believe that the universe had an origin or not. If there was a Big Bang, in fact, there's this great poster out there. A friend of mine sent me an email with an image of it, and it says Big Bang Theory, and then it's got a picture, I think it's a planetary nebula or something, and it says, in the beginning there was nothing, which exploded. That is just a great, a riotous poster from my perspective. So we've got nothing, which exploded. Well, so the question, why is there something instead of nothing? Well, if there was a Big Bang, which there was not, but if there was an origin in the universe, then you would have, well, what caused it? And that would go to this question, well, why did the nothing explode to form a universe? Now, if there was no Big Bang, if the universe has existed forever, which turns out to be the case, then the question is, okay, it's been around forever. Well, that still doesn't answer my question. Why is there something instead of nothing? And so you can kind of pick at this, inspect this question just to make sure, there's no sense beating your head against a concrete wall for 10 years trying to solve this question if you haven't really verified that this is the most important question to try to work your way through. And so then the way I did it was I actually tried to pare it down a little bit, and I started with smaller samples. The human mind really can't conceive infinity. It's just absolutely incomprehensible that you could follow some line out into space, and regardless of how far you went, there's a galaxy here, and then on the other side of that galaxy, there's another galaxy. It's just our surroundings constitute this little finite environment. And that's how our minds have been, basically immersed in this finite environment. So you just can't go there. But we have this great ability for abstraction. And so say, well, this is very, very, very big. And so I pared it down. I said, okay, well, let's just think about a little piece of something and a little piece of nothing. And so one thing I noticed was, okay, since in null physics, space falls into the category of something, it's just a very thin version, it's something different than steel, but it's still a something. And then I imagine, say a volume of space that has some stuff in it, steel or air or whatever. And so I'm saying, well, in order to understand how you get something from nothing, you really need to know the relationship between something and nothing. Because we've got this stuff here, we don't know why, but we know it's not the same thing as this empty space I'm looking at. And so I started with the space because it's easier, I thought in my mind, to figure out how to get space from nothing than it would be to get all those billions of galaxies I was talking about earlier. So I'm looking at space. I'm going from the standpoint of physics or even natural philosophy, there's been some contention about, well, it's just nothing. Is space just a place for things to happen? It has no substance. And in the late 1880s, Michelson-Morley showed that space was not a material like water or air. So it's in my theory, it's something, but that's not the same thing as saying it's a material. I'm just saying it's not nothing. And then relativity came around, and we ended up with curved space and other things that hinted to the reality, if not substance, of space. So I'm looking at space, and the best way I thought to figure out what it was or how it would fit into this very deep question is, what is it composed of? Because lots of times when you're worrying about trying to get one thing from something else, you want to know, what is its fundamental units? And so along that lines, space for everyone who's enjoyed a or did not enjoy a geometry class, think of the points of space. Space is this metric, this organized collection of locations in this big lattice. So you've got a point here, a point there. And so the sum total of all those relationships between those positions gives you this volume. Well, the weird thing about that is if you look at the individual points, they have no intrinsic properties. The only thing a point has, it doesn't have any volume, it doesn't have any mass, it doesn't have any energy. The only thing it has is a location in this space that we're referring to. And so in the most austere interpretation, then, these points have these locations. But intrinsically, the point itself has no properties. So if you were able to remove its relationship to other points, you would have quite a good representation of nothing itself. So imagine you take this this volume of space and you remove the locations, the relationship between the points, and you just get this bag of disordered points that have no intrinsic value, so you've just got nothing. And so the difference between nothing in the most extreme sense and space would be the relationship between these points, even though the individual points constitute a very good example of nothing. So that was the first clue. That's like, well, that's interesting. So we've got these things that are basically nothing in and of themselves, but by having a relationship to each other, you've now have volume. And so that was pretty interesting. Then the other thing, so I put space down for a while, and then I looked at the stuff, you know, we would call something for sure, like steel or matter. And the interesting thing about that is when you probe this stuff at very, very high energies, you don't really get any hard, fixed place where matter starts and space ends. You get interactions, you get fields, you get energy density. But it seems pretty smooth, even at very, very high energies. And current contemporary physics thinks of quarks and some other ideas as these point particles, kind of like that photon I was referring to. You've got this point, and it's got a mass. They're not sure why, but even at that, you've still got a very smoothness, a very smooth continuum. And so then I kind of thought, well, we know from the general theory of relativity works really well as treating space as this curved metric. So when I was looking at this, I thought, well, if matter was actually curved space, nothing but curved space. In fact, Einstein called matter curved empty space. Then I've got an interesting thing. I've got space over here, which is this collection of little bits of nothing. And then I've got curved space, which is matter. And it turns out the curvature of space, it's a little bit more pronounced and more complex than Einstein's theory would have us believe, but it is still just curved space. So if you take a piece of matter and you look at some point in that matter, say you had a microscope that had an infinitely powerful magnification, and you look at any point in that matter, you're going to get that geometric point again. It's just that rather than have the very, very straightforward organization of these points that you get in a volume where it's very linear, or they call it rectilinear anyway, where you go in one direction and the points are nice and neatly ordered. In matter, you've got this big curvature, but ultimately that curvature is still composed, if you look at it close enough, of points. It's just that the relationship between the points is slightly different, or in some cases quite a bit different than in empty space.
Is there a relationship between space being curved, curvature in space, and gravity?
Oh, absolutely. What the general theory is a very brilliant generalization of this relationship as it appears to us. So if we see objects moving around and we see the action and the effect of this curvature, that's what the general theory does. And what we're seeing, though, is we're seeing the shadows on the wall. We're not actually seeing the actual spatial curvature. It's much more extreme than what the general theory would really represent. That doesn't make the general theory any less accurate. It's supremely accurate because it is this relationship between the actual geometry and the perceived geometry is a very, very direct and straightforward relationship. So we've seen little bits and pieces of this idea of curved space. But then when you're trying to answer this question of, well, why is there something instead of nothing, what makes this question cause this huge, you know, pain behind the eyes and what makes people just back away from it is the perceived difference between the two states. You know, on the one hand, we've got nothing, which is just this void, and on the other hand, we've got billions of these galaxies floating around. And so if the two states were more similar, such as smoke and air, for instance, or something, if there wasn't this huge disparity, then it wouldn't be that big of a problem. Like, how do you get smoke from air? Well, they're kind of the same thing. Or how do you get steel from tungsten? Well, they're kind of similar. But something and nothing is this huge difference. But when you start looking at the fundamental geometric structure, or if you look at it in terms of geometry, and you've got, you know, basically straight space composed of points, and you've got curved space composed of points, then all of a sudden you realize that, well, maybe this huge difference that we're seeing between what we would think of as nothing and something isn't quite as big as what we thought it was. And because if I had some huge bag of points, and it's easy to get points because they have no intrinsic values, so imagine you've got this, and you want to build a universe, well, you build space out of these points, and then you curve it. And so you've got this construct, and you basically redistribute the points, and then you get matter and energy. And so this is when the final resolution of this question became clear, that going back to that poster about nothing exploding, it's a great poster. And in fact, about 20 years ago, there was some cosmologist, historically I've got a terrible memory, as I've mentioned in another podcast, but about 20 years ago we've got the situation where people were looking in terms of the Big Bang of as being an original event, that a first origin of the universe, not a cycle of bang crunches that go on ad nauseum into an infinite past, but an actual, okay, we've got nothing which exploded, and now we've got a problem with conservation of energy. And literally, if you look at the law of conservation of energy, that's basically a law that's saying you can't get something from nothing. And so that, when they were doing these calculations, they posited that if you looked at the gravitational potential, the attraction that all matter in the universe has with each other, then you counted that as negative, then, and all the stuff, the matter, the energy is positive energy, then the idea was that these two things canceled. That really what you had was this huge construct of the universe, but the total energy in this construct was zero. And that was a really interesting way of trying to get around getting something from nothing. And in our modern universe, or any time actually in the primordial universe, or any time ever, you don't have something coming out of nothing spontaneously. And I'll get to that in a little bit, why that's the case. And so they, you know, this idea really didn't go anywhere per se. We've now got newer models that have brains slapping and Big Bangs recurring over and over again. But what I thought was interesting is there's only one logical step to the solution of this ancient problem from where they were at 20 years ago. Because what they had was this nothing which exploded, and it got negative gravitational energy, and then we got all this positive matter and other energy. But what the one logical step that was missing was, well, if you've got a universe where everything adds up to zero because it came from, say, that nothing that exploded, what is the difference between that state and the internal structure of zero? And that's what the null axiom is in my book, where you say, well, we've got this, everywhere I look in the universe, I see these interesting properties. One is this positive-negative symmetry. Every time you create a little particle of matter, you get another particle of antimatter. And conservation of charge. So you've got this situation where there's always this balance running. And so the Lucretius's of 1,000 years ago say, well, why is that? And the modern theoretical physics like, well, you know, not our job, man. So, but in reality, that's a very, very important thing. Any little bit, any little clue. Imagine this, the question of why is there something instead of nothing, as the ultimate mystery, as this completely enigmatic paradox. And so you can't, if you're going to actually consider solving this and addressing it and taking it seriously, you can't just throw out little bits of evidence here and there. You need every available bit of evidence to solve this. And one of them is this weird sort of parity. So we've got this universe that adds up to zero. The space is generally electrically neutral, and we've got this charge parity. And so you kind of want, well, why is that? Well, if the universe actually came from zero, as in nothing exploding, well, then that would explain it, because you started with zero, and then you've got all this stuff, and as it exploded, the whole thing still adds up to zero. But you wouldn't think it's that big a logical step, but it turns out it's a huge conceptual step. It's like, well, what if the universe that we see is actually the internal structure of zero? And that's why it has all these symmetries. So that on one side we've got this nothing, and then on the other side, when I was talking about space and energy, you've got a redistribution of little bits of nothing. Well, there is no difference between those two states. The only difference is where you are in relation to those states. So if you were, say, imagine a series of numbers, 0 equals 1 minus 1, 2 minus 2, 3 minus 3, ad nauseum. So on the one side, you've got 0, and then you've got an equal sign, and that's very important here. And then you've got this long string of positive and negative numbers. So you're saying, well, 0 is the same as this huge string of things that add up to 0, which is only logical. You've got these two states, and they are equivalent. And what null physics says in terms of our universe is that our universe is actually an equation that adds precisely to 0. And from that knowledge of knowing what it adds up to, you can derive a lot of very interesting properties.
Are there questions that we considered to be unsolvable? You know, I don't know if this is one of them, that, for example, why is there curvature in space? For example, you know, it's one thing, I guess, to ask the question, why is there something rather than nothing? But for me, the next question is, why is there curved space and not just flat space?
That's a great question. And actually, the reason for that is, imagine that, again, that 0 equaling all these numbers. Now, if you're going to have the internal structure of 0, and if you're going to have this, say, solution to this equation, it's going to have extremely convoluted and, precise requirements. So the reason why the space is curved, well, let's start off with space itself. So it's easy to get space, as in the discussion before. You take a bag of points, you distribute it. Now you've got, instead of the equation 0 equals a bunch of positive and negative numbers, space would be akin to the equation of 0 equals 0 plus 0 plus 0. So the reason why the universe can exist as a distribution of nothing is because nothing is a component of itself. So 0 equals 0 plus 0 plus 0. So we'll call that space. And so the problem with that, though, is you get, as a result of that, you get this stuff called volume that we talked about earlier. So you've got all these points, and they've got this structure, and this whole system of zero. So if you've got nothing, you know, all these little bits and pieces of nothing adding up, as a basically the only component of nothing is nothing. So you've got this thing. Well, the problem is it ends up having a net volume. So imagine you've got 2 cubic feet of space, and so if the universe is really nothing, and it has to sum precisely into nothing, you have to get rid of that volume. And that's what the curvature does. So what you get is you've got this huge volume of the space of our universe, and then the reason why matter and energy exist is because when you curve it, into the positive and negative electric fields that we see, or, well, positive and negative fourth dimension, which we see as electric fields and motion. But when you get this curvature, that curvature actually nullifies the net volume of space so that the entire construct can add precisely to nothing.
The difference between something and nothing, you know, being a question that's obviously plagued thinkers for thousands of years, going back to our earliest origins. I think you've done a really good job of you know, explaining why that question is vital, and also basically giving us, you know, providing us with an answer. The next question that occurs to me is a logical extension of that question: where did everything come from?
Yeah, that actually is a question I typically get, and that I've already, the trick is that I've already answered it. And but because this is such a fundamental question and what I'm talking about, it touches so many different things that are pretty much equivalent, because everything came from the fact that there is no difference between the internal structure of zero and the something and a universe that adds up to zero. So what that means, and I guess that's what most of the book deals with, is we've got this idea that the universe is the internal structure of nothing. And that's basically the null axiom. And so then you just keep probing and say, well, what does that really mean? Well, to know what that means, you start looking at some of the lack of properties, if you will, of nothing. Since we're the internal structure of nothing, we didn't really come from anywhere, because nothing doesn't have a beginning or an end. It's the one thing that doesn't need a reason to exist, because it has no properties. And so we kind of slip in under the wire, because if you have nothing, which has no properties, which doesn't need to come from anywhere, but the one property nothing does have is that it is it can be a component of itself. And so you've got this, on the one hand, you can imagine this tiny point that's removed from the reference frame and has no intrinsic properties. Like, well, I certainly don't need a reason for why that exists. But then on the mirror side of that, you've got this incredibly intricate curved geometry that is our universe that adds precisely to that point. And so because those things are a duality, our universe actually has to exist. It is a... just as nothing has to exist because it has no properties, our universe has to exist because it is the internal structure of nothing. So there is no, that's why there was no Big Bang, because the universe is a fait accompli. It is a necessary extension or interpretation or expression of nothing. And that explains many, many of its properties. It explains why it is so large, because there is no limit to the amount of nothing that exists within nothing. It explains the symmetry I talked about before for charge, where you've got positive and negative. It explains the quantification, and actually, when it's looked at in a geometrical perspective, it actually explains why energy is quantized into the little packets that we see. So it has incredibly far-reaching implications. And the more you probe it, it's kind of like one of those, anyone who's had differential equations, is it's this branch of mathematics where you already know the answers and you need to find the questions. So you've got these set of answers, and it turns out in differential equations, those all are set equal to zero as well. So the neat thing about knowing that the overview and the actual sum of the universe is zero is then you can then posit things about regions of the universe that you simply cannot get to with instruments. And the funny thing is, with particle accelerators and telescopes, you can measure all you want, but you're not going to explain what you're seeing by measuring it. What you're going to do is you're going to get more and more data, and you're going to get data that correlates well, whether it's the blue sky we see in some scattering experiments, but you're not going to get that deep down explanation of what you see. Just imagine, you know, back in the day when the Greeks were, you know, playing around with different substances, and I apologize for any historical faux pas I do here, because I'm not a historian, but imagine seeing all these different things like sulfur and carbon, and then imagine also never having the technology to be able to see the individual atoms in each of those things. Well, that's kind of where we are now. We're in this place where we've got this geometry, this beautiful, perfect geometry. It's a four-dimensional geometry. And everything we see the shadow puppets on the walls where this geometry is interacting and coruscating and doing all these interesting permutations and processes. And we will never, regardless of how big an accelerator we build or how powerful a telescope we design, we will never be able to see this geometry. It still exists. It is the basis, it's the foundation for everything that we can measure, but we just can't get there. You can't get there with any sort of scientific apparatus. So what you need to do is you need to have a concept that's a powerful concept where you can connect this geometry with what we see. And then you end up with a physical science that has no limitations.
To a person like myself, I think most of us have heard the law, matter cannot be created nor destroyed. When thinking of null physics and in particular your description of matter being curved space, being basically comprised of nothing, I like your description of curved space, imagining it as a collection of points. In thinking of it that way, it seemed logical that if matter is a curvature in space, that curvature could be deconstructed. It could be taken apart. And I guess how does that fit or right itself with the law that, once again, we've heard a number of times, which is matter cannot be created nor destroyed?
Another great question. And actually, the law, matter can be created and destroyed when it's in the presence of antimatter. What can't be created or destroyed is energy. And so if you look at some matter and you throw it in with antimatter, you've got a very, very big explosion and you probably don't want to be in the same room. But the underlying substrate of all of this is energy. And energy is that goes back to the conservation of energy. Energy cannot be created or destroyed. And the reason for this is that equation I was talking about, that is the universe, is very, very precise. It's not this slapdash thing where you throw a little nothing here, you pull it apart, you deconstruct, as you say, this curvature. What you get is those fundamental quantities that we're measuring, volume of space, joules of energy, that amount of substance is the actual quantity of nothing within nothing. So it's in terms of the, I guess, permanence of energy, the two fundamental quantities in the universe are space and energy. And energy takes the form of light, it takes the form of particles. But the reason why you can't destroy energy is the same reason why you can't destroy space. There's a one-to-one correspondence between the two. And so you've got these immutable substances. Now you have flitting forms like photons and particles, but the substances themselves are the quantity of nothing within nothing. So it's literally for the same reason why the universe can't have an origin and it can't really come from anywhere. Nothing cannot be destroyed or created. And so you get this thing where, well, that doesn't make a lot of sense because you're saying it's nothing and then something. And it's easy to get confused, but the ratio, when I said earlier that nothing can be a component of itself, that's the ratio. It's this one-to-one ratio. There's a certain amount of nothing within nothing. I wouldn't say a nothing density, if you will, but there is a quantification because in any equation, whether it's our universe or any other equation, quantity is important. And so the quantities that our universe lives and dies by, the quantities that sum up so that it's precisely equal to zero, are quantities of space and quantities of energy. And that's why neither one of those can be destroyed. And speaking of that, the reason why we have gravitational fields, the reason why space is curved around massive objects is because space is a conserved quantity, just like energy. If space were not a conserved quantity, then you could, say, distort one section of space, and it would have no effect on the other sections. Space wouldn't have to make an adjustment to conserve its quantity. But that's what a gravitational field is.
Looking back at the early part of our conversation, when we were discussing natural philosophy, considering how important the application of logic and reason has been to null physics and to your book. Looking at modern science as it stands today, do we get any sense that in the foreseeable future there may be a shift back to embracing philosophy as a means of, I guess, pulling ourselves away from the telescopes, pulling ourselves away from the meters and the gauges and such, and employing logic and reason to help us to find the answers to some of the questions that remain unsolved despite the improvements in technology?
Well, I hope so. And the thing is, we need both. We need the meters and the gauges, and we need the logic and the reasoning to tell us what direction we should go and what meters and gauges we should be building. And so we do need both of these disciplines. What I'm hoping to do is, with null physics, provide the fusion between the places of the universe that we simply will never be able to measure and the places of the universe we can measure. And in so doing, provide an incredible unification that simply cannot be done by guessing which equation might or might not apply to a certain set of data. I mean, it's really kind of, I liken it to, and please, you know, I've been misinterpreted generally since this whole process started, and I'm not trying to undermine the empirical approach by any stretch of the imagination. What I'm trying to do is enhance the empirical approach and connect all the dots and actually put it in perspective where we don't have these immutable walls that we can't see behind, we can't peer behind, and we can actually connect and calculate and predict things kind of behind the scenes. If you open up the box and you see all the working gears, you're able to predict and do calculations that you couldn't begin to do. But ultimately, the proof of the pudding, if you will, is null physics needs to provide a uniform set of empirical data. I mean, if my premise is that I can take this underlying geometry and I can do quantifiable physics with it, then I need to do that. And I did quite a bit of that in the book, both in terms of nuclear physics, in terms of other things. But as I've mentioned on other podcasts, this is a kind of an unruly four-dimensional nonlinear geometry. So it's not the easiest thing in the world to apply to certain things. But what I have done is I've shown a consistent logical step that leads directly between the things that Lucretius wondered about and the things that we're measuring today. And so by building that link and building on it and doing more and more calculations and showing the efficacy of doing this, then that's what ultimately will move forward. I mean, if this were just a thought experiment and it didn't lead to a better modeling of an atom or a better conceptualization of cosmology or a better anything, if it doesn't lead to real quantifiable results, then it's esoteric. And it's, I mean, it would be interesting exercise, but it's not what science is about. All I'm trying to do is show that in terms of physical reality, there is some different approaches that will lead to places that we really want to go. And in some ways, hopefully provide better models. So these mathematical models now that we've built are based on a huge amounts of experiments and some, you know, looking for some mathematical symmetries, and a lot of stuff has kind of bubbled out of math that we followed that has worked very well, because math ultimately is the product. It's like I said, like I like to say, it's the shadow that reality leaves in our minds. But what I will say is that these models are built just only having half the picture, just the measurements. So if you have some more information about what might be going on at the geometric level, I'm hoping that models such as quantum mechanics and relativity can be replaced with better models that are not only more sweeping but don't have the huge inconsistencies, and they don't have the things where, oh, well, electron has no size, but it has mass, and they don't have these logical inconsistencies, but they actually work better when you're describing atoms and molecules.
Not to be flippant, but, you know, do we think we'll see these more effective and more accurate models anytime soon? It seems that the scientific community tends to latch on to a particular paradigm and hold on to it for dear life for a considerable length of time.
Well, there's really a big difference between some of the, you know, like the big picture stuff, like the Large Hadron Collider and some of the Big Bang, you know, particle physics and cosmologies, at least theoretical cosmology, are these fairly fairly esoteric, removed, if you will, from our daily existence and from any sort of thing we might be building, you know, in a couple of years. But I think what I'm also trying to do is bridge that gap as well, so that you could actually use these things, and you've got one big continuum. And now, will we be able to build a better thing with the Large Hadron Collider? You know, who knows? In many of these cases, you don't know that what's going to happen until you do it. And I'm a fan of exploring things, but I'm also a fan of logical consistency. And I don't think you should do anything just based on consensus. I think everything should be backed by a reason and a paradigm, and not just, you know, dotting the I's and trying to work out something that is kind of a dead end, but something that you can connect back on itself. Whereas, for instance, if we keep going, as I mentioned, I think in another podcast, the Big Bang has had a problem with the matter antimatter symmetry for 75 years. And so at the current rate, you know, we could be looking at another 50 years or an interminable amount of time before that might be resolved to at least a reasonable level of satisfaction. So it's things like that where if we make, I think science, even the theoretical stuff needs to be a little bit more, I don't know what you call it, beholden, but a little bit more grounded or logically consistent. And then, you know, that would be what I'd hope for some sort of a continuum instead of some abstract regions that, by their very nature, don't touch us.
It would seem that we're far away. You know, considering in your book, for example, when you're, you know, dealing with or discussing some of the things that remain unknown or unsolved, you make the mentioning that. Particle physics, for example, probing into, you know, quarks and pions and some of the other smaller unstable particles, and you make the mention that you know we're moving onto these smaller and smaller and smaller types of particles, and we still don't understand electrons, for example.
Yeah, and that's the point. The reason why we don't understand a lot of these measurements. You know, there's one thing to describe and there's another thing to understand. And to really understand them or understand anything in our universe, the only way to do that is to know why the universe exists. That's physics problem number one. So you can wander around with all these other things. Now, you certainly can't stop bringing the entire technological development of our civilization to a screeching halt until someone comes up with a reasonable explanation for this. But what you need to do is you need to not punt it somewhere. You need to recognize that yes, this needs to be addressed, and don't tell us that we're looking for the secrets of the universe when one of the biggest secrets of the universe isn't even being addressed. And that's one of the things I do have an issue with, that it's been a very long standing thing. Well, we're doing this or we're doing that, and we're probing the secrets of the universe, and there are piles and piles of secrets of the universe that are collecting dust and have not been even, you know, looked at. And all these secrets come into logical consistency. Like, well, why would this be that way, or why would this be that way? And that's why, you know, we need to do both. We need to do the measurements. We need to do the correlations. But we also need to do a lot of thinking about how all the stuff works. And that's what null physics represents. It represents the fusion and the geometry. And from my, you know, well, will it be embraced in the next, you know, 50 years, 20 years, 5 years, 5,000 years? I don't know. But I am confident, or I guess I found so much good correlation and so much compelling evidence for its accuracy and for the reality of this geometry that I'm referring to, that, you know, I'm patient. The universe doesn't really care whether or not we start measuring certain things or certain other things. And that's where you go back to that original natural philosophy where people really believe that there were true things. There was something that is either true or false. It's not just a model. It's not just, the data fits the points. No, either this thing exists and it's a real aspect of our universe that we can measure here and measure there, or it doesn't. And that's why what's interesting about my book is that when I deal with cosmology, now I'm dealing with the Big Bang, and I'm saying either that's one of two things happened. Either there was a Big Bang or there was not. So, spare me the mathematical models, because that is a true or false question. It is a truth. And regardless of how much we measure, how much statistical analysis is done, it either happened or it didn't. And from my perspective, a huge mass of weak evidence does not constitute strong evidence. Because if there's just one or two little bits of logical inconsistency in whatever we're explaining today, then it has a problem. And it's not like you can fix logical consistency by measuring something else. And like I said, whether it's the matter or antimatter, some of these logical inconsistencies have been extant for 75 years and zero progress. I mean, every time we've tried to, or they've tried to measure this asymmetry in particle accelerators and come up for a reason for why this asymmetry exists, they've failed, and it continues to be this glaring error. Well, that's the universe telling us that, hey, this didn't happen. That's the universe telling us that this is false. And some parts of the universe's exam that it's giving us do have true and false questions.
Well, as per usual, this has been a very informative and interesting podcast. I for myself, have had some very, very large and probing questions, answered that have been bothering me for a long time. So I appreciate you taking your time to sit down with me today, and I look forward to our next podcast coming up in the near future.
Sounds great. It's always been fun. I never tire of fighting the good fight.
And you are indeed fighting the good fight. I wish you a happy holiday to your family, and we'll talk again soon.
Sounds great.
You have been listening to Null Physics, Our Undiscovered Universe, with scientist and engineer Terrence Witt, interviewed by William Reynolds. For more Null Physics podcasts, visit OurUndiscoveredUniverse.com and click on the podcast banner.